Hello everyone, my name is Emeka Okereke and welcome to yet another episode of Nkata Podcast, Art and Processes. And today I'm going to be speaking or having a conversation with a visual artist, a choreographer, a contemporary dancer. His name is Kudus Onikeku. Kudus was born and raised in Surulere, district of Lagos, Nigeria. Very quickly, he had the urge to express something of himself. And it was at the age of 5 that he began to accumulate series of acrobatic prowess. Through his love for acrobatics, he discovered dance at the age of 13. He would end up in France, specifically at the École Nationale Supérieure des Arts du Siècle, where he studied and graduated in 2009 with a special interest in acro dance. Since then, he has managed to create a movement identity that fuses dance and acrobatics, while he makes the Yoruba traditional philosophy his basis and combining it with several other influences such as hip-hop, capoeira, tai chi, and contemporary dance vocabularies to weave a certain understanding of dance, art, politics, and everything in between. Kudus has participated in major exhibitions and festivals across 56 countries, including Venice Biennale, Biennale de Lyon, Festival d'Avignon, Roma Europa, TED Global, Torino Danza, Kalamata Dance Festival, Dance Umbrella, Bates Dance Festival, etc. His dance works is in the permanent collection of the National Gallery of Canada. He has been a visiting professor of dance at the University of California, Davis, and Columbia College, Chicago. And currently, he is the first maker in residence at the Center of Arts, Migration and Entrepreneurship of the University of Florida. And this we'll get into later in the conversation. But beyond all of this, Kudus is also somebody that I know and I have shared experiences with, intimate experiences, professional experiences, and all of that. And our paths have intertwined. And he's someone I would call a friend when we are not at loggerheads and having differences. Much of our conversation today is going to revolve or build from that. What I just read out now is just a small chunk of his biography that is formal, but from here onwards, we are just going to, you know, put all these formalities aside and just have some real conversation. First of all, let me say welcome, before I get ahead of myself. Welcome, Kudus. So,
thank you for having me, Mika.
But one thing I want to, you know, read out from how you presented yourself on your website, and this is for me, you know, how I think that we should sort of like enter into this conversation, is it goes like this. In 2004, I began a solo career and have since then managed to maintain a healthy creative life. Through my artistic journey, my interest has been more and more drawn towards the aesthetics and artistry of African peoples in general. It is in my belief that the socio-economic political conditions of a given time usually informs the given culture of the time. In the view of this, I have been looking closely at the questions of contemporary Africa, its aesthetics, and its identity in its wider sense, the differences, the discourse about it, the power play around it, the instability of reality, the chauvinism, the colonialism, the hegemony, the migration, exile, and the noisy confusion that they all produce together in my daily reality and that of humanity. Now,
I never heard anybody read this to me.
Exactly. That's the thing. This is loaded. This is loaded. Mm-hmm. It is all encompassing. Mm-hmm. But again, I know that you also have the benefit of an illustrious career, consistency, backed up with time to sort of like shore up and defend this assertion. So now I have said, or I read out, in 2004, you began a solo career, but I know that it also goes way beyond that. So people might think that it started in 2004, but actually it started at the age of 5. And then it became even professional at the age of 13. So can we go all the way back and start from there?
Oh, wow. First, I'd like to say, you know, when you were saying we shared a professional, you know, life or whatever together. I mean, when you say intimate, I wanted to say, you know, we shared bed together.
Okay.
When you had just one studio and there was only one bed.
Yeah, I think
we had to sleep.
Exactly. But I think I have to make an insert in there that we were all in Paris, and Paris was a crazy place. And I was at the Boza while you were also at the École Nationale Supérieure des Arts du Siècle. However, we didn't go to that far, that extent of craziness. Huh? So I just want to make an insight there that we didn't go that far. It was a time of experiment.
The journey has been somewhat more like a malediction, actually, than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You knew at least a huge chunk of those years and beginnings
mm-hmm.
where we will be together in Paris, you know, and and we will talk all the way, you know, to like 5 a.m. the next morning mm-hmm. and we just catch like 2 hours sleep. Then we even forget to eat, you know, most of those times.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was not the hunger. The hunger was you were existing within a context where you are in this école. I like when French would say école nationale supérieure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're in this superior school. That is to say, this is the highest height of elite thinking
mm-hmm.
in our country. And the people who are here right now, who are going to finish from these schools, are most likely the future we are looking at for the way we think about art. Not just in this country, because this country is also, this also thinks that is the center of the world. Mm-hmm. So in a way, in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you are also a student in that kind of school. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this because it's the same for you and I.
Yeah.
And
to give this a context, what you're referring to here is, you know, how our paths crossed in the Paris of the very beginning of the 21st century. It was just 4 years into the 21st century. I always make a point to emphasize, because I think that we are going to always come back to the fact that this was how the 21st century started. And much of who we've turned out to be was informed by that urgency when we came into Paris, Nigerians, Anglophones.
Yes. No, speak French.
Don't speak French.
We had to learn everything.
We had to learn everything. Yeah. And so we came into this place where we realized that immediately it is important to begin to work, deliberately work for, for how specific we want to convert all of these experiences.
What is really important to also kind of like note about that period was also the fact that just like you and I, we were brought up within a context where we were as well centralized in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We were not imagining ourselves or explaining ourselves vis-a-vis a whiteness or a white model of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We were fully Black in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, a robustly Black. That is to say, we were not even thinking
mm-hmm.
of Blackness. The Black, we're so Black, we're not even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because we're not, for me, I have a feeling that Blackness is a construct that exists solely beside whiteness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Without whiteness, there would be no Blackness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we were existing with that kind of context. Then coming to France in a space that is already strange in its entire setup.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it was England, you know, there were some things that you can already recognize, or your United States. But France was so other already mm-hmm. to
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
Then this othering now threw back this othering at you. Mm-hmm. You're like, wait, I'm not the other here. Mm-hmm. I think you are the other.
Mm-hmm.
So the space you create for me to exist within, I am not okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the work we were doing at that time was in the work of defining for that other how we should be looked upon.
Mm-hmm.
And that work, you now realize that, oh, wow, there's a whole revue noire, there's all of this work that has been done ahead of us,
mm-hmm.
and we're still here.
Mm-hmm.
You arrive, you see where things are, and you feel like, you feel compelled that you need to start from zero.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize at some point in your journey that, no, all of this work has been done ahead. So I don't need to start from what they've done. I need to start from where they stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the luck I think
mm-hmm.
I had.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, you realize that all of this amount of work has been done. So where do I take it from? Who am I actually having conversation with?
Yeah.
Realize that you're actually not having conversation with the whatever they call the French scene, where you were having conversation with the amount of ancestors
mm-hmm.
that have been there.
Yeah, exactly. Before. So this is very interesting. So, but hold that thought there. Let me still take you all the way back, because we can easily get lost in this trajectory. But let's go all the way back to how it all started for you. I mean, all the way back, family, yeah. Because our conversation, I wanted to be, first of all, to begin from the place of, you know, how did you become? Because you were talking about coming and meeting this reality, but then realizing that it wasn't, that you're not a consequence of being here, that you were somebody already. It's just that there was no context to articulate that person and give value to that person. So now much of your CV, much of my CV reads exhibition here and there, but very little about, you know, what our parents, people in our community, in our societies have done to make us that person. Mm-hmm. So let's go back all the way.
I mean, I think in my first work, my exile, I mean, my first real major work after school, I started the piece with a voiceover. And the voiceover reads, in my father's house, there used to be this little space that leads into the loft. As a child, I'll find myself often scrambling my way into the space where no one was paying attention. I'll be there for a very long time. I'll feed myself with my thoughts. I'll imagine things. And looking back into that past, I realized that there's always been this sense of exile that seeks to take me away from the collective of my family at that time. Now, coming back to what we were talking about, my father has two wives. I grew up in a typical Egba, Abeokuta man's house. Mm-hmm. Two wives, everybody living together, 13 kids. I'm the 12th. Mm-hmm. What that means also is that you have 11 people in front of you, mm-hmm. who kind of like know life more than you. Mm-hmm. But outside the 13 children, cousins, people from Abeokuta, events, parties, there is always noise and there was never a moment of calm and mm-hmm. silence. Mm-hmm. But I'm also, don't forget that I'm also using my adult mind to talk about this kid now. Mm-hmm. This kid didn't know any of the things that I know now. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a whole bunch of things that the kid is trying to iron out. Mm-hmm. That he already knows, but he doesn't know mm-hmm. that he knows them. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that was the path that led that kid to the first person he saw in his own space of truth that did an acrobatics. And there was a remembering, there was an instant connection that happened with that, with what that was. Mm-hmm. Then he started by himself repeating this acrobatic prowess, mm-hmm. going to look for his own tribe, doing break time in school or closing time. He goes with those tribe of people and they start to do acrobatics together. Mm-hmm. So that was the first, that was why I said that was the first sense of doing something from his own will, mm-hmm, especially mm-hmm. growing up as the 12th child mm-hmm, in a big family. Mm-hmm. And now he starts to express this where everybody is, his family, his brothers, his sisters, his mom, his dad. The way they reacted to it was in horror. Like, oh, you want to kill yourself? Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Don't ever do that again. Mm-hmm. So already, he already started from age 5, 6, knowing that freedom of expression is not free. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. there is a repercussion. There is a way mm-hmm. at which authority or people who feel like they have authority mm-hmm. over you will have to define how you use that body.
However well-meaning sometimes, though.
However well-meaning, it doesn't belong entirely to you. So that was already some realization. Then now, how did this boy figure out a way to continue to be that little 12th born boy, mm-hmm. at the same time, continue to grow mm-hmm. as an acrobat mm-hmm. in closet, if you like. So there is already something about, yes, expression, but you need to find a way to express it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not just going to be like, oh, because you don't have the entire free space to do it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And which for me, it brings back to also the question of the artist. And especially within our own context as Yoruba people. Mm-hmm. The Yoruba people are very keen about language, mm-hmm. about the way you say it. Mm-hmm. It's not about what you're saying, mm-hmm. about the way, the manner, the proverbs you use, the way you chose them rightly, mm-hmm. that it doesn't mean something else. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that idea, that way of constantly playing with dangerous substances has been part of my making from the beginning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then don't forget, my dad is a stout, devout Muslim. He's mm-hmm. an imam.
Mm-hmm.
Like, dance in Islam mm-hmm. is haram.
Wow.
Yeah, dance is not, no. It's a no-no.
Really?
You speak to, and when dance started, I started speaking with brothers and, you know, in the mosque. Like, what does Adik say about this? What does Islam say about that? It was a no. But something inside of me that has been pushing me since age 5 until this moment I started dance at age 13.
Mm-hmm.
But don't forget that at age 8 was the first time I heard Fela's music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was also a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I already knew that, yes, my mom has all these records,
mm-hmm.
you know, Shino Peters, Sonny Ade, Obey, Ebenezer Obey, all this, Victor Waifo, all of the Oliver Ali Cook, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom didn't have Fela.
Interesting.
So it was my brother that went to school at the University of Ife one day and came back home because he was part of the student union and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And brought back this cassette of Fela's music.
Mm-hmm.
That for me was like another, the same thing the acrobatics did
mm-hmm.
at age 5 was precisely what Fela's music did at age 8.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? I didn't understand the politics of his music. But I understood the music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I understood the underlying message, the subtextual
mm-hmm.
message
mm-hmm.
that was being disseminated. And don't forget,
What do you think at that age now, going back, without sort of like projecting to that, what do you think is responsible for that understanding?
Don't forget, there was all the concert conversation about going into the loft,
mm-hmm.
going into the trees, going to the forest alone, being alone. It's as if you're looking for a voice or you're waiting to hear a voice. And Fela's voice, that's why I say, I don't ask me what was he talking about? What exactly did he say that made, it was just that voice.
That voice. Interesting.
And now, powerful. That voice is not just about what he was saying. It's about the music, the text, the composition, the cacophony of his music, the polyphony.
Mm-hmm.
All of that spoke to me like, no music has ever spoken to me.
Wow, because it's not, you know, it's not just the music. It's so many things layered and
yes.
makes me feel like we're really like jumping the gun, because something comes to mind now about some of the things that you've said about your work, which is imagery. You know, so I was watching one of the videos and then you said to the dancers, if you are dancing and I don't see an image, then there's nothing. But again, I wonder, what is that image? Is it like something, is it like an image, a photograph, or is it just, is it like the voice?
Okay. So in the Yoruba tradition, we believe, in the Yoruba language, actually,
mm-hmm.
the word for spectacle, let me use the word spectacle,
mm-hmm.
which is what we also connect to performance, is iran.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go watch a wrestling
mm-hmm.
show, is iran. If you watch football, if you watch basketball, if you watch a dance show, go to concerts, if you watch a magic performance,
mm-hmm.
all of that is iran. Even if two Agberos are fighting on the street
mm-hmm.
and you stay to watch, that's iran.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an accident on the road
mm-hmm.
and you watch, that's iran.
Mm-hmm.
So now, already, please hold that thought.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is not textual.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's anything that feeds the eyes. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Yorubas will say, Iran lo nje oju. So that is to say, performance is the food
mm-hmm.
for eyes. Now, the eyes is attracted to two things,
mm-hmm.
mostly. Beauty or performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an image is called a woron.
Mm-hmm.
So now, both iran and aworan, they have the similar root word,
mm-hmm.
which is iranti. Iranti means to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So aworan, which is picture, is aworanti, something you look at to remember. So
at the end of the day, central to it is memory.
In this context, I would even say it's not even about memory.
Mm-hmm.
It's about remembering. For me, the actual question is to remember what? To remember what? Because what you're looking at is not what you are remembering.
Mm-hmm.
What you're remembering is actually what that thing triggers and is making attempt to show you.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard Fela's music, what was I remembering?
Even as a child.
Even as a child. Now, before we go too far, let's now come back to my latest work, which is something that I felt like was the reason for all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Reincarnation. If reincarnation is to be the base of Yoruba worldview, Yoruba culture, just as Christianity and its understanding of life after death
mm-hmm.
is the base for Western logic of mm-hmm. everything,
mm-hmm.
linear thinking, whether we go to heaven or hell, mm-hmm. is a linear journey.
Mm-hmm.
There is a finality. Dante started his journey in hell, passed through purgatory, and ended in paradise.
Mm-hmm.
This idea is alien mm-hmm. to Yoruba conception of things,
mm-hmm.
of reality. Mm-hmm. So if reincarnation was at the base of our thinking, then it's clear what the child was remembering.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear then the purpose of performance.
It's very powerful that this whole tie-in, you know, reincarnation to remembering. And even now we come to the body, and you said the body remembers. But again, the body does not work like the brain. I mean, it's connected to the brain, right? Because it has all the muscles and all those nerve systems.
Yes.
But again, the body remembers. That is to say, it is possible for it to remember something that is not immediately conscious of.
It's not even lived memory. That's why I didn't want to use the word memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, interesting. Now, you know, like we're already going in and in, but let's still come back a little bit. I want to ask, when you were growing up, you grew up in this sort of like, I can even imagine how, you know, dense and always people. I can imagine that also contributed to your, you know, speedy or fast development in life. And at the age of 5 already, you were doing things because you had all these people in front of you that you had to sort of like, you know, look up to, but also meet up to.
Yeah, and, exactly. Meet up to their expectation of you.
Yeah. So, but what was it like? What was the environment like? Was it hostile? Did you feel at that early age, if it was love or if it was just hostile? Or what was it like?
Oh, it was bliss, really. I've had a lot of people who have a similar polygamous families.
Mm-hmm.
It was in school or meeting people that I realized that polygamy was something somewhat negative to some people.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it was all like joy
mm-hmm.
because you get to have two mothers,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
like literally. And if one is not attending to you the way you want, you go and meet the other.
Mm-hmm.
To a point whereby it was actually my stepmom that we call mom. My mom, we call her Sisimi. Sisimi is like my lady.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why everybody call my mom. Yeah. That's what we call her.
Yeah.
But the person we call mommy is the first wife. Yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
That we actually call mommy. And out of the 12, you see, I still do it unconsciously. I would say I have 12. You know, 11 brothers and sisters in front of me. Because we don't even separate who is this one, who is that one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for example, while growing up, I might tend to even be closer to my stepbrother
mm-hmm.
than I am to my brother.
Mm-hmm.
So there was all of this harmony and this love, mm-hmm. which I really credit my dad, especially now that I'm becoming a man.
Mm-hmm.
I credit my father for that kind of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And how to navigate that.
Mm-hmm.
And also to also say, it is now that we all are now becoming grown-ups, having our families, then already to have a time for your extended family is already like a whole lot of work. Then to now, so that's when you begin to prioritize, like, okay, let me, you know. But at that time, growing up, it didn't exist at all.
Mm-hmm.
The separation or the kind of tension that people might connect to polygamous homes.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't at all in our reality.
Would you now say that as a man, that it comes natural to you now to think that it's okay for you to be polygamous and have another wife? Because you say, you talk about it as if like there's nothing whatsoever about it that was wrong. I came from a home that is supposed to be polygamous, but our own was sort of like madhouse. Everybody with plenty temper and just destroy the whole thing, you know, just messed up the whole thing. But again, I've always now again, becoming a man and becoming a father as well, I'm beginning to think to myself, what was that all about? When It could have just been people looking to coexist simply for the fact that you are aware that there are other people coming behind and that you are on your way out. And at some point, your life becomes about making the way for their own becoming. So what is this sort of like loggerheads that you continue to have with each other, not paying attention to those ones coming behind? Is it that really necessary? You have, or you had a different version of that being together that was more like a very constructive and beneficial one. Will you now say to yourself, okay, it's fine for me to actually, because I can do it?
To focus on polygamy will be to get to misunderstand the point. But to look at the real lesson, which is coexistence, cohabitation. And that's why I give my dad the credits every time. And I think I learned a lot from him just by understanding how all of that played out. Yes, we were kids. We didn't see all the intricacies and all the things that was really happening until later, much more later. And now my elder sister telling me, oh no, this happened. And I'm like, oh really? I didn't see any of those things. But now, so for me, it's about the charisma of a leader. That's number one thing that I learned, that that's very key. Number two, it is the acceptance and the agreement of two women to coexist within one roof, where their most fragile, vulnerable offsprings, which are their children, exist as well. So the question is, do we live together? We find a way to live together?
Because we made this reality.
This is the reality. Now, the question is, how do we make it work? And I feel like the lesson is something that even till today, I still use. Whether it's something I will replicate or not, maybe I'm already replicating it in my company or in the ways I work with people. Knowing fully well that no two individuals, no two different distinct human beings will see life the same way.
The same way. And that what's most important is to bring them to a place where they agree. And
even if they don't. Even if they don't, coexistence is the most important for me. You don't even have to agree. Coexistence, that you must agree, admit to live together. And now that's where the mathematics is. We must encode that in our law, in our financial systems, in our educational programs. We must encode that idea of cohabitation because we don't have anywhere we're going.
That's very
interesting. The one thing my dad told me lately, my dad is 88 now. When he was 80, I did a piece, the one I did in Avignon, and I did that piece deliberately to honor him. It's called Kaddish. And during the research for Kaddish, I took him to Abeokuta, which is ironically the first time I was going to go to Abeokuta. It was with my dad. And we went to Abeokuta, went to the family house, and had a lot of conversation. And myself and him, like we made a whole conversation about his life, about the choice for polygamy. I asked him. And even though it was a very uneasy conversation for him, but he told me that it wasn't his plan. He never planned for it. It was, now that we are all men, we can understand. It was situation that led him to it. Now, he already knew it in his head that I'm not going to subject my first wife to the terror or the violence or, all those complications. I'm gonna have another wife, but we're gonna figure out a way to make it work. Now, this is just one. Last year, before I came back to the US, because anytime I'm home now, I make sure I spend time with him a lot. And it was then, you know, made it clear to me that when he had a second wife, they only had one room in Ebutemeta. I'm like, what? One room with two wives and like, I don't know, six kids? How? Like, how? How did he do that? So beyond the subject of polygamy, I'm more enchanted by that possibility, which that, I know that, is that so is impossible.
You know, that
it's so impossible now.
It's so impossible now. When you became a dancer, you know, this is fast forward age 13 now, and especially with this, you know, a new light you've shed on the reality of it, which is that even within your belief, that is something that was prohibited. So when you became a dancer and you started dancing, going to the National Theater, I guess, doing all of that, how was it received? And how were you just able to sustain? Did you just say to yourself, no, it's not dance, it's acrobatics? That's how I justify it. How?
I think it's a terrible terror for a child, especially just getting into teenagehood, to be confronted in a face-to-face manner with God. If acrobatics was the first expression of my own will, dance was the first expression of defiance. Not only defying your parents, your society, but almost defying God. Because they told you that this one
is a no-go.
Is forbidden. So now you got to choose.
Yeah.
You got to choose. There's no cohabitation possible there. That was why I was told. So you begin to kind of like do the thought process all by yourself and looking for the rationale. And the conclusion, of course, is one of the things that led me to my unique, solitary kind of Muslim that I am today. Because the rationale for me was, listen, one thing that you are very sure of. Because now, let me make it clear. From age 10, I've been crazy about religion. From age 10. Like, I literally spent days and nights in the mosque. And I think the mosque was just a replacement of that loft. Don't forget.
Yeah. Interesting, the metaphor of the loft.
Yo,
I'm going up, going so up. It makes me think of Ta-Nehisi Coates when he said in that book, The World and Me, that he wrote for his 15-year-old son. There's an excerpt there where he says, I will not have you descend onto your dream.
That's
I will
it.
Not have you
yes,
descend
right.
onto your dream.
Yeah.
You know, it's so powerful. So it's like going up to the loft. It's like ascending onto your dream.
Yes.
As opposed to descending onto your dream, which is settling for secondhand goals. Which is,
for sure. Yeah. If I can't get that, then let me go to the other one.
Exactly.
The other possible one. No, for me, I feel like there's been a search. And it's very important that I mention all of these because, you know, later on in my life, I would get to understand even better. That thing I was looking for, I felt religion was a kind of a response until there was that conflict.
Loggerhead, yeah, conflict. How did you go through it as a young lad? I mean, how did you not just abandon it? Like, I know that you don't drink wine. Like, I'm drinking wine right now. I know that even though you have accepted dance, even though contrary to your religion, you didn't say, okay, now that I've been able to pull this one off and giving myself a unique kind of, let me follow with other things.
And I think that's the thing, because eventually it was a misconception and misunderstanding and misreading of God's intention that made people feel like I have to hold on to the symbols and to the rituals, because at least that gives me any kind of grounding in the face of in the invisible, in the face of I cannot even touch, I cannot even really see. But dance gave me a much more greater and intimate connection to that same God that doesn't pass through any prophet or any middleman. It was a direct connection. And I knew that in my body. I knew it first. So all the people I was asking, they don't know what I know in terms of what I've felt, what I've experienced. So one thing I said to myself at that point was, you know what, you forget these people. One thing that you are very sure of is that it wasn't Satan that gave you this talent.
Yeah.
when we are settled, when we are done with that one, then we now begin to negotiate the conversation with God.
I'm thinking that there would have been at least some form of support system. Can you go back now and really remember in a very clear way one thing or one person or a group of persons that were a support system for you within that community that you think that just gave you the push and made you think that, okay, you know, just keep going on this way?
The support system is the dancers themselves. You see, I feel like the world have not really, really, really understood what dancers mean to this world. Somebody will ask me a question about, oh, you know, there's no funding and all this thing. How come dance is still growing in Nigeria? And I will laugh.
Huh?
And I will say, listen, erase dance as profession. Erase the theaters in this world.
Mm-hmm.
Erase all the music video.
Mm-hmm.
Erase all the critics. Erase selling out, mm-hmm. you know, in a big theater, selling shows, tickets, everybody. Erase the idea of fanhood,
mm-hmm.
following. Erase likes. Erase everything that is material about dance. Dancers will be coming and going out of this world every day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is profound.
Mm-hmm.
The moment I tell dancers this, it shakes them. Because what I'm saying is, now have you asked yourself, why exactly are you dancing? Have you asked yourself, what if we erase all of this thing that we've erased? How do you define success? How do you say, wow, the show today was hyper successful? How do you determine what success is? Even when there is no audience, nobody is looking at you. Everybody is a dancer. Nobody has the interest in watching you. That's, for me, is where I begin to understand that there is something divine.
Mm-hmm.
In this old conversation about the body.
Mm-hmm.
Our body is the house of everything.
And all of that, was happening even before you started seeing a glimpse of how lucrative this could be.
Precisely. Because the first thing was a perception. And that perception came from that age we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It came from 13. I was a science student, mm-hmm. at 13.
Mm-hmm.
How I finished science class, I can't even, if you ask me, I say, I don't know. I didn't fail SS1, mm-hmm. fail SS2, I didn't fail SS3. Okay, SS3, of course, I have a lot of F and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But how I was going to the next class, I don't know. Because it was like a trance. People will be doing physics tests or physics exam. And my friend will say, Q, we're going for rehearsal. It's not even a show. For rehearsals. And I will drop that paper right there and there and I'll follow. That was how crazy the thing was. It was like it was a pool. It was a trance. I was entranced by dance. So it's not even something logical that even till today I cannot make a sense of. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've done more and more and more and more research and work and thinking and meditation,
mm-hmm.
to understand what this was.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that my situation is not unique.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of dancers will tell you exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will ask them, how many kids do you have in your family? We are like 5. How many of them are dancing? It's just me. Why? So I feel like there is a certain kind of memory that we have been, it's a kind of malediction that we've been stung, by that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we must continuously follow it,
mm-hmm.
until we have a sense of fulfillment. I doubt we will ever have that in this lifetime.
How did you end up in France, and how can we just go into that a little bit? And because I think that was a very unique period in time for many of us. So what was that transition like, moving from a space like Lagos and then finding yourself in the plane and then going all these places and then ending up in France and in school?
I think France arrived as one of those accidental bus stops in one's own journey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You never thought about it. It wasn't a reality,
mm-hmm.
until it happened, you know? I mean, we all met at the same time. Yourself, myself, mm-hmm. Asha. Who else can we mention? A whole bunch of us. Even Sheung Kuti, that was where I met him. Like, a whole bunch of us, actually. That space was a very important space because it was the space where we all gathered and realized that in a very unique way, our experiences are not all that unique.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, there's this one. This one is not even dance. This one is own crazy photography. This one is own crazy singing. That one is painting. This one is drama. Then, because of that journey, that same journey that I talked about, maybe you might know better,
mm-hmm.
how when I started getting interested or subsumed in your work as a photographer,
mm-hmm.
because I wanted to identify the familiar,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in the unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm.
I remember you were the one that introduced me to Keziah Jones music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, as you may know, myself and Keziah, we work every time now. Again, the last music, you're looking for the familiar
and the unfamiliar. You know, Chinua Achebe said in the book, there was a country. There's a place, mm-hmm. where he said that he realized that he was born at crossroads. So he was referring not to when he came to the US or when he started traveling or when his work. He was now referring to where he was born already, that he was born already into this duality. And this is something that a lot of people don't give credit to Chinua Achebe for, but he expanded a lot of thought on duality, especially going back to the Igbo concept of duality, where one thing stands, something else stands beside it. So something where one thing stands is the familiar. There's something else that stands beside it is the unfamiliar. And you are looking to reconcile it. Every time it's pulling you, it's also sometimes invisible. So again, we know it as invisibility, that as you stand here now, there's a you that stands beside you, but you don't see it. That's but it's propping you up. You know, people have called it gravity, but that's not how we call it. We don't, it doesn't push you down. It stands beside like that. It's almost like, you know, in the art school, they tell you to draw from the negative space. That is to draw in the shadows so that you can make the form materialize. So it's almost as if that many of us, myself, you, Asha, all of us, we were running with this negative, not negative in the sense of bad, but what has been propelling us is not what meets the eye, but the unfamiliar. It's something also I feel like many people don't understand where our energy comes from, because they are looking to see it in the known, in the familiar. But we are born to constantly know how to be in the unknown.
That's it.
And try to reconcile the known with the unknown.
I don't know if it's peculiar to us, because we grew up in Lagos. Everything is already cosmopolitan from the beginning.
I didn't grow up in Lagos.
I
hope you're not adding me to the us. That's what I'm saying.
No. That's why I'm saying that. Either it's that, or it is connected to the artist temperament. Mm-hmm. But what I know for sure is that humanity will benefit a lot in that way of seeing otherness or all the thing that is estranged, or the stranger, the alien, the étranger. If we realize that the other, the stranger, is actually a carrier of what could be, we'll begin to look at differences in a much more robust and much more beneficial way.
Open way.
Yeah. Because you have more to gain.
Exactly.
You got more to gain from the other than the other have more to gain for himself.
Yeah. I often say that the reason why I don't subscribe so much to the concept of atheism is not because the person does not or have made a declaration that they don't believe in God. In fact, if anything, one thing we have in common is that none of us have seen God, both of us.
Exactly.
That we have in common, you know. But where I have a problem is how it closes off. So in other words, you can see that in someone who is a religious fanatic who closes off. That person is no different. So the atheist who closes off because I don't believe in God is the same.
The same way. Because there is a conclusion for both of them.
Yeah.
The religious fanatic as well as the atheist in that form. Of course, I know different kinds of atheists as well. Mm-hmm. But in that radical atheism. Yeah.
Closing off.
they meet at the extremes. Mm-hmm. Both of them, because they are extremists, both of them. Mm-hmm. So feel like it is that liminal space, again, coming back to Achebe, that middle ground that I feel, I sense that is responsible for how it was so seamless for all of us to respect, to see, to identify, to connect, and then to seek, even if we never collaborate, even though you and I did, and I did with Asha as well, but if we never did, it doesn't change anything. What I'm learning from you is not really about the collaboration. What I'm learning from your practice is the way at which eventually I translate it into my own practice. What I learn from all the books I read is not a direct, you know, carryover. No, we are making translation. And because to connect the dots, you know, Bob Marley said, we have to fulfill the book. Now the book has been shattered and has been torn into pieces and has been thrown into different parts of the world. To gather that book together, you must be very attentive, very observant. You must be listening deeply. You must see with your inner eyes. So that is the work. And until that book hasn't come together, if we have not remembered membranes, all the membranes of the body, if we have not put it together back, we cannot even forge an enviable future for us.
This is so powerful. But again, when you're talking about bringing it together, is that not a utopia that is perhaps unattainable? Is it meant to come together in that sense, or is it sort of like about the strands that connect things?
Well, when I say together, please, I'm not speaking physically. I'm not speaking convergence. No, I'm talking about now you as an individual, as an agent. How are you together? You as an individual. You as an individual, bro. Mm-hmm. You as a maker. If you understood something about Igbo landing in the UK, is in the US.
In the US, yeah.
If you understood something about the influence of Igbo culture in Haiti, if you understood what Igbo people have done all over, because what we are trying to get back, I always say that we are trying to remember the future and rewrite the past. Mm-hmm. What that means is that the past that we've been given, the history that we've been handed over, it's in itself already a broken one. And it is one that we can never, ever be able to forge a stable, non-angry, not fighting sense of self, not moving, not performing, not showing, no Afro spectacularity, no negritude, no tigritude. I'm just is. I just am. Mm-hmm. So now to discover that just being, it requires a whole sense of wholeness. Mm-hmm. And it is that wholeness that I'm looking for.
Wow.
That wholeness that says, What if there was never all of this? Mm-hmm. What kind of work will I want to make?
Yeah. What kind of work would you want to make if there was no post this, coloniality that, you know, this is this? What will you make? How will you reach for your own personal poetry? And for me, it's also your own. That's where recently to believe has become less important than understanding. Because there is something about, I mean, the Jamaicans say even overstanding, you know. But for me, what it means is that that understanding is unique. It is unique to your own way of navigating. You begin to understand how you understand things and why you understand things the way you understand
why it. You are the context, We can be genius even without any memory. We can be genius without any devoir, any assignment. You know what I'm saying? So if, because I always look at Fela's music, for example, and I would say, well, what if Fela was not fighting anything? What if he wasn't subjected to all those neocolonial animals we call leaders? What if he wasn't subjected to racism or black power? I have to go through all of that. What will be his uprightness? How do we learn to be upright without conflict?
Without conflict. This is a very, very powerful question that you've asked, because you know what I feel like? You know, when you talk about remembering the future and rewriting the past, this is just it. Don't forget that we are all pioneers of the 21st century. Questions like this are proactive. They are not reactionary. Because when you say, how can we remember the future? It reminds me of the very first sentence that Chinua Achebe opened the book. Again, there was a country. There was a country, wars, you know. And that wars is not the wars of the past. It's that wars of remembering the future. Again, like you have just said. In that first sentence, he opened it, he said, a people who does not know where the rain began to beat them, There is a situational here. Where it began to beat them, will not know where they got dry. So you think you've arrived. You think you are at a position. You think that what you are dealing with now is the conversation you should be having. You think that what is preoccupying you now is what should be preoccupying you. But that's because you don't even know where the rain began to beat you. You think you are dry. Of course you are dry, because because he didn't negate the dryness. He said you are dry, but you wouldn't know where you got dry. The where there is this where you're supposed to be? Are you not supposed to be remembering the future as opposed to be stuck here?
The real key point for me is, and it's a word that also appeared twice, even more than twice, the people who do not know will not know. Whatever pronoun or whatever thing you add to that afterwards, a people who do not know
will not know. Exactly.
Let's even stay on that one. So knowing, which of course is a byproduct of consciousness, is precisely what I'm about.
Amazing.
It is the bringing into consciousness. Now, this consciousness can do anything if it likes. This consciousness can say, the way I want to react to this consciousness is to become a prostitute. It's a consciousness. The way I want to react to this consciousness is to own my body plainly as a girl. I want to dance. I want to shake that same ass that they killed Hottentots, you know, Venus.
Yeah. as a result of.
He's the same as I'm weaponizing and I'm bringing it back.
Yeah.
The proactiveness for me also goes into, it's not a conversation. The people upon which it has been impossible to have any form of conversation with other than violence. And I say to myself, okay, I agree. But now there's a different kind of violence that one can still bring.
Mm-hmm.
What about gun? And I think it was Fela that was the first to say music is also a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
What is the weapon that we are now bringing? So it's not even about asking the question of why can I not do that? Can I do that? But it's saying I am going to do this.
Yeah,
I am going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It might take you another century or another decade
but
to
I am
understand
going to do this.
Why.
Interesting.
But I am going to do this.
All right. So, you know, you mentioned our collaboration, yeah? So it got me thinking. We collaborated. We have worked on a project, traveling. That was the very first, you know. Now we're talking about who introduced who, what to who. You know, I remember that fateful day when you came and showed me the proposal you were writing for Prince Klaus. And then we sort of like walked through it. But none of us knew what we were doing, but it was just this intention, you know, and intentionality to make it happen. From my own end, I remember that was like the first real project that you took on to really organize and get funding for and put together. And we can invariably say that everything you've become today started with, you know, the intention to do that project. Take it upon yourself to do this. I would say it's the same for me as well, because it was when I traveled, made that trip, especially when we arrived in Maputo, that I saw, you know, the performance you did at Katembe was basically what I replicated eventually. When I did my residency in Maputo for my final exams in Adeboza, I went back to this same Maputo and I photographed and I had a public space exhibition on that bridge. That very bridge that you and I were crossing back and forth, because we came with the idea of crossing the bridge and having the performance on the other side in Katembe as opposed to Maputo. It was exactly that. I was asking myself, how can we do the same photographically? That is basically how our practice has intertwined. We collaborated, yes, but it also continued within the work itself. And I've been thinking also this whole notion of the body, because I have been having this question about the body. In Invisible Borders, our project over the years has become also using our body and our presence as an object of useful agitation as we take ourselves through that. It's a performance. When we subject ourselves to all of that crossing of the borders, it's not so much about the photographs we make, the writings. It's also using our body as an object of useful agitation. But now, when we talk about body, you are the person who you do it every day. So let's have this conversation about what your body is for you. How do you use it as a weapon, like you've just said? How do you use it as a tool? How do you animate it? Why do you animate it? How does it operate for you? I mean, I'm saying all of this as someone who doesn't work directly with the body, but still understands that.
Either it's colonization or slavery or lynching or war or rape or any other kind of trauma, we sometimes forget that it is the body that we're actually talking about. The slave, this one always gets me laughing every time when I think about it. The slave that runs away and they say, run after him. And you ask, what did they steal? What did he steal?
Yeah.
He stole his own body from the hands of those subjecting it to enslavement. That one kills me any day.
That's very interesting.
That way.
Because the slave cannot steal anything properly, because it will weigh the person down. No material things. It's just the body is the only valuable thing for the slave to steal.
He's stealing his own body.
This is so powerful, man. This is so powerful what you just said. And it can be applied to the time today.
For sure. It's the same. Again, let's now look at religion, for example. It's the same. When they say you have sinned, already the whole concept of sin is something I've grappled with. Like, what does it really mean? What does it really mean? And who has the authority to make that assertion that the way at which you have just used your body is sinful? When we use language sometimes, you also realize the level and layers of oppression embedded in those words.
Mm-hmm.
Most especially when we talk about the body and sin, especially within, of course, I think they're the only one that talks about sin. There's the Yoruba now, nothing like sin. But it is Christianity, Islam, and Judaism the Abrahamic religion, they are the one that brought up this concept of sin. And this concept of sin is entirely connected to the concept of hell.
Mm-hmm.
So, and most of the time when we talk about body and sin, we are mostly talking about the woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it is that temple that is the temple of sin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of lust and all that.
And of lust and everything, anything sin is about that same woman's body.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So let's imagine that it was actually a woman that conceptualized religion. Will they consider that aspect also
a sin?
A sin.
Ah, interesting, 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 interesting. How would giving birth to somebody be seen and how sacred will it be? For example, in the Igbo culture, the ground is feminine and...
Yeah, in Yoruba.
Yeah. And I've always found that so powerful. Even as a prayer, sometimes I pray. Because we are in a place where you have to pray even for the ground under your feet so that you can stand. When you have that thought in your head, you are praying to a goddess, basically. So what if a woman conceptualized religion? What will that be? The ground will be sacred.
A whole lot will be, because she will, in my opinion, we will look at femininity from the sacred positionality of reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
So now, how come anything that aids reproduction, how can it ever be considered a sin?
Mm-hmm.
That's number one question one we ask. And how do we then look at even medicine, finance system, education?
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to look at all of this if we already, at the back of our mind, for example, ailment in other traditions is something that you create an enabling environment for the body mm-hmm. to have capacity
mm-hmm.
to fight against whatever ailment.
Mm-hmm.
That's how traditional medicine reacts.
Mm-hmm.
Western medicine wants to kill the ailment.
Mm-hmm.
There's this logic of war.
Mm-hmm.
So there is always a war, there's a battleground
mm-hmm.
that is always being drawn,
yeah.
especially talking about violence.
There is a
language of violence that is embedded in everything
mm-hmm.
that we don't take the time. One of the greatest teaching of patience and understanding how long time can be is in the process of consummation and, mm-hmm. and gestation.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that 9 months, if it comes too soon, it's still there. It's, mm-hmm. it's premature.
Yeah.
If it comes too late, it's still there. There's
yeah.
time.
It has to be precise.
We realize that there is time. And I think that also time and care and caring is something that is entirely feminine.
Mm-hmm.
That I have a feeling that, for example, Yoruba people say that when they say, oh, may this year be feminine,
mm-hmm.
it's actually a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
In Yoruba, normal prayer, may this year be feminine.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it is feminine, there will be peace, there will mm-hmm. be fruit, there will mm-hmm. be rain, everything will be fine, the yang will grow.
Wow, that is so powerful.
Yeah, when the year is masculine, there will be only war and craziness and COVID-19. So the concept of woman, of female, it's not even something that we know so much,
mm-hmm.
but we know something about feminine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the space of disparity between the Western conception of feminism
yeah.
and our own understanding of femininity. Yeah.
And much of also how feminism is being framed is also within that, you know, flaw of the Western sure. conception of it, because it's never how it has operated. It's something that is sacred.
It is always material for the Western logic
mm-hmm.
because everything is desacralized and everything, because of course the moment we cut the head of our kings and priests and popes, we already imagine that there can actually be a dichotomy between the spirit and the body. So everything is not conceptualized within the framework of even the body that they don't understand is a sacred temple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's always material. And that, for me, that materiality is what I struggle against, is the immaterial that is most valuable mm-hmm. in Yoruba thing.
Mm-hmm.
When they say beauty, they are not even talking about the external beauty. They say Oju Ewainu, meaning the internal beauty.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that we are looking for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because that's what we are looking for, we don't even care whatever form it comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because the form is not what encapsulates beauty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
what encapsulates beauty is the innate character of the thing. We mm-hmm. call it Iwalewa.
Mm-hmm.
So that Iwalewa house that we're all seeing in Germany,
mm-hmm.
what it actually means is the innate character of something is what encompasses its beauty.
Mm-hmm. This is really powerful. This is really powerful. I saw a video where, you know, one of the dancers was saying, like, you know, the way Kudus's kind of dance is that you have to sort of like be free and it has to come from within. And there is no one prescription on what you need to put out there. You always have to be yourself. How does it relate to this whole idea of, I mean, you've already answered it, but how does it relate to this idea of subverting this understanding of the body and how we have approached the notion of the body? It's so interesting that you started from this, you know, angle of telling us, look, first of all, let's debunk how we even understand and talk about the body.
That same guy that was talking about that video you saw,
mm-hmm.
that his dance is different from within.
Mm-hmm.
The same process, the process I took him and the rest
mm-hmm.
through in that work, he was the one that came to me and said, ah, Sakira, you know, I have one question. I said, what? You know, our pastor told us that any energy that is not for Jesus
mm-hmm.
is evil. It's evil.
Wow.
How do I make sense of this thing that is happening to us here?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People are going into trance. We are connecting with a very deep space,
mm-hmm.
but you're not doing it in the name of Jesus. That's where the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he doesn't believe what was happening to him,
mm-hmm.
but because we are not naming it in the name of Jesus. So in the churches and in the mosque, maybe not in the mosque so much, but in the churches, trance is desired. But not in the
in the name of Jesus.
You know what I'm saying?
And they're not speaking in tongues as they are trancing in your dance.
Exactly. And that for me is where the dichotomy lies. But we are talking about the same process.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the same process of entrancing the body.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we now bring out of it as information is where we got stuck, the brain. The brain is telling you that what you feel is, you feel like it is powerful, but your brain must also follow. If your brain cannot follow, then there is a problem. Mm-hmm. However, the brain is the one that has been educated, religionized, mm-hmm. colonized.
Mm-hmm.
It is the brain. Mm-hmm. That is where the whole question of the body also becomes important for me, because the body now feels like it remains the only space of, I mean, I won't say the only, but at least for dancers, is the most attainable space of redemption.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the mind has been badly colonized and educated.
Mm-hmm.
The soul has been taken by religion. The body, in a very interesting way, feels like the only sacred space remaining as the space of redemption, because it has been untouched. And even when you toil a body, when you go to gym, you see what happens. You get more muscle, you get stronger. The more you toil the body, the more you inflict pain. There is actually a way at which the body gets stronger through pain.
Wow. It is encoded into the body to sort of like get stronger through pain. It's almost as if it is also like a process within nature. Nature does that. Nature has this way of empowering itself. Mm-hmm. So because it's not violent. So it nourishes from the violence and mm-hmm. rises above it.
Mm-hmm.
And rises mm-hmm. above it.
Adapts.
Yeah.
It's elastic. Adapts.
Yeah. So, but then the small minds, we want to always want to kill it. And you know, you're talking about the killing. The other day, I used this expression for somebody. You know, the person asked me something. I said, well, you know, that was sort of like my way of killing two birds with one stone. And then we laughed. But when I left there, I was like, what was that analogy again?
What did the bird do to you?
Yeah. I was like, you know, I for the first time, that's when I realized that, look, there's a whole lot of unthinking we are doing. I don't know if because I've turned 40, but there's a whole lot of unthinking we are doing, right? That, you know, it's, before you wouldn't even think of it. You thought you'd spoken some really good English. Mm. But I'm like, wait a minute. Why would I want to kill a bird? For what?
Not less of two with one stone. What kind of skill is that?
And besides, there's so many other proverbs and adages in my own Igbo language that will make up for that.
I would have said the same thing without talking about violence.
Yeah, without talking about killing birds. Killing is the key word there. You know?
So I was like, okay, man, we are really messed up. And it is important that we, again, that's why I really appreciate what you said about remembering the future and rewriting the past. Because, again, it's like Tinu Achebe again said that the biggest problem with Nigeria is that what we have in our hands are people who have forgotten how to rule themselves.
That's profound. Because they used to.
Exactly. They have forgotten. So basically, misplaced priority. Not putting, not really focusing and taking constantly from that knowledge. We have forgotten. Yeah. But this forgetting, again, is no longer operating as something that is in past, like you have just said. It is now remembering the future. It has to be. It has to be remembering the future.
And I think the real work is, again, is in the work of excavation of the relics. And that was what I was trying to say of remembering, because the explosion was not done and kept in one place. Was done and was dismembered all over the world.
Yeah.
There's a whole number of information that you will need now as a Yoruba person that you will only go to Brazil to find it.
Wow. Look at the dispersal. Look at the... Wow.
Me, for example, as somebody who at a particular point in his career got interested in Yoruba philosophy, I cannot tell you that everything I've read is written by a Yoruba person in Nigeria. No. Majority of what I've learned about the Yoruba philosophy is something that I had to go out to
outside.
Find.
Outside.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So for us to find that thing, to look for differences, is not going to help.
Yeah. Yeah.
To look for the familiar is what is going to help.
To look for the familiar in the unfamiliar. And I love this. And I love it as a very proactive position. As a position that, so like, you know, the tiger does not need to declare its tigritude. Just keep going, because you are looking for the familiar in the unfamiliar. And it's scattered everywhere, like you said. What you are saying right now is the same. I realize that the Igbo language and all the proverbs and everything, the cosmology, the worldview, has already prepared you for everywhere you're going to step your feet. It's already prepared you.
Oh, for
sure. Right from day one. So what we are doing now is to embody it and be it and
take it on.
There's something I want to ask you, still on the subject of the body in relation to your work. Something you wrote on your website, again, I'm coming back, you know, so I read out to you. You know, you said, I have by no means felt at ease with the saying that dance is a language or a form of expression, and often outraged by audiences who want, by all means, to understand my performance as one probably understands a piece of writing. Language can do less when dance is in view and forms denote something fixed. Body movement, or simply put, action, has always been a superior mode of thought and of communication. Therefore, the contextual meanings in my performances are neither eternal nor immutable, but mere signifiers in time and space. For me, a performance is simply an experience, not a cerebral one, however. It is rather a brief shared moment of vitality, of healing, of sensorial purification, where one sometimes makes allusions, antisocial behaviors. But above all, it is to meditate between the here and then, and to make balance. What I find interesting is that you had to pitch that against the whole notion of language. So can you sort of like shed some light on that? Expand on that. What do you mean by, you know, dance is not a language in the sense?
Number one, this website, I've not edited it in a long time now.
Okay, so you have to get back to it then. You have to go to it, because it's your about on your website.
Because I have my, I know. I have some other, I will do that. I have some other newer website with some newer writing. When I wrote that text, I was living in France, and I was having a kind of a direct conversation with this consistent need to want to understand everything textually. And people have come to tell dancers that if you cannot explain what you're doing, then you don't know what you're doing. That's where I'm coming from. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I say, okay, maybe we have the same body. Oh yeah, move that your body to a point where it begins to move me. You cannot do it.
Yeah.
So what are you talking about? So that it is that body intelligence that I was trying to make a case for. and to say it's a real thing and it exists and it has its own value.
Mm-hmm.
I might not be able now to tell you in proper language what it is, but maybe that's not the point. Maybe the point of it is not anthropology. Maybe the point of it is not to say this is what it was, but the point of it is, did it happen? We feel it. So if we can feel it, then why don't you give yourself the, you know, the calmness of just enjoying it or experiencing it without necessarily making a case for it? Because it's like invisible borders. You have been able to make something that is presentable to those who didn't make the journey. But can you ever finish telling somebody about the experience?
Oh, yeah. That, you know, that's the thing. You know,
the greatest value of a journey is being on the journey.
Yeah. Simple.
That's the value.
That's it.
So, and that for me is what I try to make people sometimes understand about dance. The greatest value of this dance show is being here. Every other thing that we bring out of it is a reflection of who you were before coming here. Because I don't know you, your ways of seeing has already been defined by who you are. So you will never see what I'm showing you. You will see what's looked at you. You will see that moment where you find the eyes that looks at you in my piece. That's what you're going to see. So if we already kind of like agree on this celestial understanding of coming together in contact to anything. So I'm like, okay, then what do I want you to experience? Maybe that's where I can now understand my work as an artist who has made 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 pieces. And I have seen when it works, when it really works, is what we call, is what the flamenco people call ole moment. It's an ole moment. The Yorubas call it ashe. And you see those ashe, coming back to what I was saying earlier, if what if there was no industry of dance and all of that, the reason why we dance, it is to make balance. It is to create a brief, usually it can happen and it cannot happen in a show. But when it happens, it's a brief moment of suspension. It's a brief moment of healing. It's a brief moment of vitality. It's a brief moment of breathlessness. It's a brief moment of stopping time. And you have goosebumps, you have your head, there are different ways we are all going to experience it. All of us in this room, we experience it different way, but none of us will be able to come out and say, it didn't happen. Now, because it's just a brief moment, the show might be 1 hour. And because you are a critic or because of whatever, especially in Europe, we love to navigate our way into experience only through the negative. So we will not talk about an experience of 90 minutes about that bodily experience we have because we don't know how to articulate it. And we always want to know how to. Then when we come out, then we now hold on to the methodology and
and what didn't work and what's because that's the only way you can make it a
based
criticism.
On our memory of what we brought into the theater before even the show.
Yeah.
Before even encountering the thing.
Now that you're saying this, and I also have a question that I want to ask you. So for someone who works with his body in a very, you know, a lot of us talk about how to be in the now and how to be in the present. And it's conceptual. Because when you're thinking of being in the present, you're not in the present. And so it demands a sort of like letting go and be in it. Mindfulness is not easy.
Yes.
A lot of people think it's easy. So I've always been curious about how it works for someone like you who, after rehearsal, you've been rehearsing for like 2 weeks for a show. Sorry, for a performance. But then, on the day you're going to into the stage, you know that everything that you're going to give to that moment is totally, almost dependent on how you feel inside. There's nothing else. And then someone, imagine that one of your family members now come and infuriate you, anger you, or you hear a, you get some news about somebody dead. How do you reconcile with that way of being? How do you shift this person and then say, I get back to myself so that I can be this person on the stage? How does how do you still stay in the present?
That's of course, you can already imagine. I've had many, many instances of what you're saying. One that I can easily say was when I was having a tour in Benin Republic. Mm-hmm. On the day of the show, in the morning, we went for breakfast in the hotel in Paracou. Mm-hmm. And we went back to the hotel, and everything was stolen in my hotel room. My laptop, my passports, my camera, DVD player, whatever. It was just, the most important one was that without that passport, I don't even know how I'm going to go back to Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And that passport has my French visa still valid in it, my Russian visa, Tunisian visa, and American visa, mm-hmm. four visas still. Mm-hmm. And then, this. Then let's go to the police station. We spend the whole day dealing with that matter. I have a performance at 7 p.m.
The same day?
That same evening. And they all said, should we cancel the show? I was like, no, we're not canceling the show. Emeka, this is one. Two, reincarnation, this piece. We've been working on it for a year. We were just having the last period of rehearsals coming on. Mm-hmm. Then we lost an important member of the piece, Love Divine. She died. And the title of the piece is Reincarnation. And it is three chapters, birth, death, rebirth. So death until that moment has been conceptual. When she died, her boyfriend is in the piece. They live together. He has a solo in the piece. The day she was going to die, before she left home, she told him that he should do that solo that he does in this piece, that she loves when he does this solo, that this is like the best thing he has ever seen him do. So he filmed him dancing and say, oh, wow, this, so you can hear our voice behind the camera. Now, we're going to come back to rehearsal a month later. We've not been able to all gather because it was during lockdown. We only did a Zoom send forth. We came back to the studio. We've not been able to finish creating the second part, which is death, because it was not coming. Now, we have to work on death. We've separated the three parts into white, red, and black. The middle part is red. Love Divine, if you see any of her picture anywhere, she always has red hair. She has a solo in that piece that was already been written. And when she's doing that solo, everybody is hyping her. And they're like, and that's what she would do. She was the one that came up with that idea of Sarah Bachman. When, after I showed them Sarah Bachman video, she was like, okay, I have a solo. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. See the way she shakes her backside. Mm-hmm. That I've never seen anything like it before. Mm-hmm. Like seeing it, it does something to the male gaze. Mm-hmm. So you come back to the studio, dancers are the most sophisticated when it comes to body intelligence. And the body is the only tool. You know, so whatever the body is carrying, just like you've said, grief, pain, headache, bad news, heartbreak, whatever, it's there. It's real. You can't use Panadol for it. You know, you cannot use medicine to take it out. No, it's there. And that is where now you also get to understand that the way I work as a choreographer, I've already touched at that, even in my mode of composition, in the way I choreograph, in this whole idea of healing, in this whole idea of trauma, this, which is at the core of everything I do, in the whole idea of body memory, in the whole idea of shaking and going into trance, is already there. So actually, the more heavy, the heavier the experience, if you are able to connect to the space I'm pushing you to as a dancer, the more sublime the performance will be. The heavier the experience, the more interesting the performance is. Which exactly now, this guy, I was going to then write up his solo. Because of course, we're just experimenting. We have not really written it mm-hmm. before she died. Mm-hmm. And I've after like a week into the process, I didn't touch it. I touched everything else. I didn't touch it because I know it was still griefing. Apart from the fact that they live together, this is the boyfriend, he hadn't had a moment. He has been going to the hospital, to the police station, to mortuary, to... It was an accident. It was a shock. This is like a shock. Nobody like just called you. She posted something on Instagram like...
A few minutes before that happened.
Yes. She posted a video on Instagram in that same costume that she died on. So this is a heavy experience for all of us. Heavy. And when I was going to write that solo, I made sure that everybody go. It was at night. I said, everybody go. I want just myself, the musician, and Ambrose. For the next part, I had nothing to tell him. Like me, I'm like, what do I tell this guy? How do we even start? His eyes, we see that at that time. Yeah, he doesn't sleep. He cries. Then we're able to make him just go. It's like when you just push someone, you know, just push him. And he trusted me. He trusted me because I told him, I said, what we're going to do for your solo is two things. The more you do this solo, the more you're going to heal. And the more you do this solo, the more you're going to have the capacity to bring back LD and dance with her. So you're going to dance with the invisible. But for you, she is here. So that idea of presence is something that now that we're beginning to tour the piece, is something I told them, I said, guys, don't you ever forget all the imageries and the ideas and the concept and the vivid stuffs that we use to create this thing. Because every night when we perform this piece, you must see her. You must vows with her. You must do it with her. You must call her. So we now structured the solo as a kind of a journey for him, where he goes, arrives in this space, this liminal space, sees her, calls her in, and we use light, you know, red light. We try to make sure that everything is kind of like following that logic. And the music, the sound, the way we did everything. Now, and I told them on the day of the premiere at Sun Pompidou, I said, guys, this is not a show. You know what we've gone through to make this thing. Every night, they don't need to know. But we that knows, we must use this as an opportunity to call, to pray for them, to heal and release them. To do that, you don't do that after 5 minutes on your phone, pressing your phone. To do that, you have a whole day before the show to meditate. Because the prayer is not really happening only on stage. It's from the day, the moment you wake up, you start to mentally prepare yourself for that journey, because it's a journey and it's a dangerous one.
It's like every moment is a visceral experience and you bring all of that to the stage. And maybe one of the reasons why I now ask this question is because there is always this concerted effort to recognize the audience and that there's someone there watching. But what if there's nobody?
We changed that exactly based on what you're about to say. We changed that. And that was what I also did for my dancers a lot, because most of them start from posting videos on Instagram. The eyes of the followers, of the likers, of the whatever commenters is so important for them. Mm-hmm. And that was what I was able to break over the time and say, see, the point of performance is to invite, is to form a circle. And then during the show, you enlarge in the circle. And you invite the audience into the circle. Mm-hmm. It's not showing them. Mm-hmm. It's not a spectacle like that. Mm-hmm. It is a ritualized space. And in this ritualized space, you are a participant. You are not a voyeur. Mm-hmm. I'm not deliberately packaging something for you. No, you only happen to be there. So for me, the logic of seeing that I use to make my work is the logic of imagining yourself going into a forest and you happen to bump into a group of people doing a ritual. Mm-hmm. That is the positionality I want to give the audience. If you decide not to come into the space to join us, then you don't make sound. Mm-hmm. It's either you come in and say, oh my God, you guys are doing a ritual, so let me join you. Or you just
stay quiet.
You have just one eye.
and you stay outside of it. Yeah.
You are outside of it. That is the position I put the audience. So whether you are here or not, it will happen.
Wow. That's a form of clarity that is so important, especially this whole idea of the positionality, because much of what we do is about that relationship between the person creating and the person looking. And oftentimes artists are sort of like struggling with, you know, where the balance is. I'm creating my stuff, but at the same time, there is this other part of it, which is I must keep it going. But how? Where is my positionality in all of this? And you just use this metaphor of saying, look, you go into a forest and you just find people doing it. It means you, basically, they weren't thinking about you when they found themselves there doing their thing. So you just happen to be there.
Which is different from the position the Western logic puts the audience. And oftentimes I see some of their bright mind when they have their moment of luminous, you know, thinking, I hear them say, if the audience is not there, there is no art.
You know?
And it sounds nice. It sounds cool. But I'm like, okay, maybe that's why we don't do art.
But you know, yeah, the reason why that is because of this, again, very simplistic notion of collaboration. It is that kumbaya-ness. Let us dance together and do. But together is in and of itself a complex word.
Yeah.
As complex as beauty. Yeah. It can go beyond space and time.
Yeah.
Together for me means that Frantz Fanon basically understood that he would die because he has leukemia and he is going to die. He went nevertheless and worked and worked and worked because he knew that if he gets this right, it will go beyond him. That's together. Is it together that he's not going to be there to enjoy? Is it together he's not going to be there to be part of? That kind of collaboration, that kind of collectivity is for me. Why, you know, when we talk about the audience, I'm like, what does it matter if the person is here now? The person might meet this work in the next 30 years, in the next 40 years. Nobody stops you from coming into the forest. Forest belongs to everyone. But I'm not going to be in the forest, you know, by virtue of if you're going to be there or not.
Exactly. And again, also because, again, let's even now take it into a much more further complex space. Now, he who talks about reincarnation already talks about time and space at the same time.
Yeah.
Space, in our own conception, is in three folds: space of the living, space of the ancestors, and the space of the spirits, which you can also call the unborn. There are three different spaces. But these three different spaces revolves at the same time. Just the same way at which is 1:30 p.m. here in Gainesville. It is 7:30 p.m. in Amsterdam. But we are both here speaking at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Different spaces, different time zone.
Yeah.
That's one way to get into the conversation about space of the ancestors, the living, and of the unborn.
Yeah.
There's no past, present, or future in that.
Mm-hmm.
It exists at the same time.
At the same time.
At the same time. So, if I now understand that I can do a performance here right now, and I plug in my Zoom or my StreamYard, and my StreamYard is streaming to Facebook, streaming to YouTube, streaming everywhere. And that's all I needed.
Mm-hmm.
Then I do what? I go in.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, whether you now come here to my door to enter into my space and look at me here, I'm already aware that people are watching me from Amsterdam, from the US, from Nigeria, from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same conversation about space. When I'm doing a performance here, I'm also intermediating. I am mediating between the here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, the masquerade is actually the greatest example of what we call performance.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole purpose of the masquerade performance is to mediate. If somebody, for example, like LD, Love Divine, the girl that died.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's imagine she actually died through occult processes.
Mm-hmm.
Her spirit is angered as spirit have left this world in a shock, the space of departure can anger her spirit beings, mm-hmm. her heavenly friends or mm-hmm. mates. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they can throw upon the living mm-hmm. maledictions. Mm-hmm. This is another sophisticated angle mm-hmm. of what a performance can mean. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I tell my dancers that every day we perform, it is going to be to invite, to appease, and to supplicate, and to, after the show, release her. We are creating balance. Mm-hmm. We are healing.
Yeah. And it's so interesting how you sort of like make this correlation between balance and healing. And I find that very interesting. Balance, healing. Another word I will add to that is harmony. Now, the thing I want to ask is to come back to this position that you had in this, your text, although you say it's like an outdated text, but the one that I read out in the beginning, and it's like mm-hmm. this very all-encompassing, very proactive, and, you know, ending with humanity. It is big, it's ambitious. Your work is not only in dance. It's gone beyond that. You're also a curator and a convener, and creating spaces and platforms for the performance of togetherness, like I like to say. So will you say that, you know, looking back, especially with the benefit of time, you know, and I think we have to be appreciative and thankful, because we are saying time, but at the same time, you're super young, which means there's still a lot that can come from where this is coming from. But yet, you know, for someone who is this young, there's a lot that's been done already. So will you look back and say, well, that everything I have done, the way I've gone about it, the encounters I have made, the people I have nourished with my work, the talents I've passed on to people, everything is tangible enough for this very paragraph here not to be seen as just a metaphor.
Which is?
This paragraph. Do you want me to read it out again? I mean, this is the paragraph of, you know, you talking about, it is in my belief that the socioeconomic, political conditions of a given time usually informs the given culture of the time. In the view of this, I have been looking closely at the questions of contemporary Africa, its aesthetics and its identity in its widest sense, the differences, the mm-hmm. discourse about the power player around it, the instability of reality, the chauvinism, the colonialism, the hegemony, the migration, exile, and the noisy confusion that they all produce together in my daily reality and that of humanity. So you're using these really big words, so like everywhere. So will you say that I also picked up something that you said in one of your videos where it's like, okay, now I've been in France, I'm coming back now. What I'm looking for is to sort of like transmit my talent, my knowledge, everything to this, you know, young dancers. And from there, we advance towards victory. So all of these ways of talking, you know, in a society where things are messed up, where people really want things to be more tangible than that, can you say that your work is tangible? Can you say it's not just in the realm of metaphor?
Okay. When I made that video, that was in 2005. Yeah. Sorry, 15.
Yeah, okay.
And that was the first, that piece you saw was the first work I did in Nigeria mm-hmm. with young people. 2011, that same generation of people came with me to Centre Pompidou to premiere Reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Those young people, they are presently at the core of the revolution that's happening in the dance world in a global scale, what they call Afro-dance. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who are the maker, the setter, the designer of that aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And now we have formed a conglomerate, or should I call it a collective, mm-hmm. of them from Abuja, from Lagos, from Kaduna, from Jos, from Benin. And now they are about to travel, really, mm-hmm. all over the world. That's tangible, even though it's art. Mm-hmm. But there is another aspect of it mm-hmm. that is precise. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there was a point in my career as an artist where I no longer feel comfortable with the separation that exists between art and society, mm-hmm. where I really want to merge those two things together. Mm-hmm. Because really, art is not important. What is important is what we want art to do.
Yeah.
So if it is art, if it is curating, if it is social commentary, if it is mentoring, if it is entrepreneurship, if it is whatever, we should not lose focus of what we want to do. We want to achieve something. We want to fulfill the book. It's the same conversation we've had in Paris since how many years ago.
Yeah, since.
It's not different.
It's not different.
I'm not losing my focus on that.
Yeah.
If you look at my work from that very one you talked about, doing the Coca-Cola to dance, mm-hmm. if you look at it up until this very moment, it's all one book. They're just different chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, with all the experiences, all the things, all the wins, all the money, all the collaborators, all the co-producers, all the access point that I get in the world, I drag it back to where I feel the next work should be,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is in the building of those who are coming after. Because during the day of the premiere, they ask me, say, Q, you know, you've been doing all of these things, and sometimes we feel like, what exactly are you expecting of us? That was what they were asking me. Because they know that it cannot just be for nothing now. All this work. Because they're not asking us to pay anything, you know. But what exactly are you expecting of us?
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, I said, nothing. The only thing that I'm doing is that I'm setting you up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a setup.
Mm-hmm.
Is a set of more than an expectation.
Yeah.
Because if I was not the only one doing this, if we had about five, just 10 more people who are like in the dance field,
mm-hmm.
doing the same amount of work,
mm-hmm.
in the whole of Nigeria, can you imagine the revolution that we're about to bring? No, and I told them, I said, that's the point for me. The point is that I know that something greater than what we've done is possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's no cloud around that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
To now bring that into reality, because don't forget, everything starts with a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Thought is abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Then to move from thoughts to matter,
mm-hmm.
that's the journey.
Mm-hmm.
So now I feel like all my work now, including offstage,
mm-hmm.
including working in Bariga or in Yaba or whatever.
Or in Florida, in Gainesville there.
All of it, whether it's in Florida, whether it's in Paris, whether it's in the U.S., in Nigeria, whether we just collected Global Memorial Hall from the state, whether it is for that, there is a connection between all the works.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is no connection, there is no way we can hold it up together.
Mm-hmm.
Because only one thread, only one needle carries the thread.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, my own work eventually I don't even know what, as Kudus,
mm-hmm.
is to constantly think about the thread. But right now, as we speak, the thing is blowing up. And even me, I'm like, oh, do we still have our hand on this? or is it actually time
to let everything go now? Very interesting. I mean, because I was going to ask you that question about what is the whole insistence on a revolution within dance? For instance, for me as well, there was a point where I was thinking, oh, photography has to sort of like spread and do this and that. But today, I don't do only photography. I do many things. I think for me, it's a given that art is not important. I really don't care. What I care about is people empowering themselves and not letting anyone give you your agency. Because Fela said, you can't dash me my property. You know, it was already my agency. The whole concept, the whole premise of agency is that it's mine. So don't let anyone think that it can give it to you. Don't give the person the benefit. You have to find it yourself. This is where I am in everything that we do. You have to find it yourself. So why are you thinking about, you know, bringing revolution through dance as opposed to just staying on, well, I do as much as I can to just make people feel empowered? Is it like a part of you that is trying to sustain your profession?
The thing is, it's for two things. One, I think we've dwelled a little upon the whole idea of the body,
mm-hmm.
as a private museum,
mm-hmm.
as a custodian and conservator of not ancient knowledge, as a conservator for the possibility to remember the future,
mm-hmm.
as a possible space, you know,
as a possible refuge.
Now, when I say, I'm not even talking about for dancers.
Mm-hmm.
I say, so far you have a body,
mm-hmm.
as an African,
mm-hmm.
and wherever you are in the world, as a space of remembering.
Mm-hmm.
again, talking about performance and remembering. Because you see, the thing about dance also is that whether you are the one on stage or you are the one watching, we only watch dance with our body. Mm-hmm. There is a direct transmission going on. Mm-hmm. So when the dancer is on stage and she's jumping 10 times, be rest assured that even though you are sitting, you are also jumping 10 times, mm-hmm. whether passive or not, mm-hmm. whether active or passive, mm-hmm. you are actually an active agent before a performance, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because a whole number of things happening to you. Mm-hmm. You might think you're only looking at it from your eyes or from your mind, mm-hmm. but actually you're actually watching it from your yeah. whole body. Mm-hmm. That's my belief, my conviction, mm-hmm. and that's what I'm propagating through my works, and that's why I want to show it everywhere, mm-hmm. everybody, mm-hmm. for redemption. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Mm-hmm. The number two aspect of that is that, and this I tell my dancers a lot, I say, listen, just like I said earlier, what is important is consciousness. Mm-hmm. The way it is going to play out for you is going to be extremely different mm-hmm. from the way it plays out for me. Mm-hmm. Also, because as a Yoruba person, we believe, just like you understand that as well as Igbo person, you believe that everybody has his own chi. Mm-hmm. Everybody in Yoruba has his own orisha. Mm-hmm. And my own orisha is Ogun. Mm-hmm. And Ogun is the deity of irons. Mm-hmm. In other words, of war mm-hmm. and creativity. Mm-hmm. So you know that there is already a certain archetype or certain temperament that is peculiar to you, mm-hmm. which is that of going to where it is difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, keep touching at that place where it is difficult. Mm-hmm. And I feel that that's just a personal thing. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the work. Mm-hmm. The work is what I first said. Mm-hmm. The second one is my kind of person. Mm-hmm. Always searching for the conflict, always searching for the space of something to yeah. grind with. Mm-hmm. And is that in the grindness that it becomes heat and it becomes, you know, warm. And that heat is now what we turn into kinetic energy that we use to fuel everything else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in all of that that I just said, is profession really important? Let me tell you the truth. If it was for dance alone, I cannot even make the kind of money I spend in sustaining all of this thing. Mm-hmm. So actually what has really sustained me as a person mm-hmm. in this world mm-hmm. is actually not that.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, this has been a very wonderful conversation, Kudus, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm also happy that we've been able to catch up and, you know, ruminate on these things. So this is a really good place to end. Now speaking to the audience or to the listeners, if you've made it to this point in the conversation, thank you for coming with us on this journey, this wonderful, you know, visceral experience of a conversation. You can leave a comment in your most preferred listening platform. Could be on Apple Podcasts, you know, Spotify, on the website, Overcast, Amazon, anything, you know, just leave a comment, give your feedback, and of course, we'll be in touch. And if you want to know more about the project, it's nkatapodcast.com. If you want to support the project, it is nkatapodcast.com/patron. So thank you very much, and of course, see you in the next episode. Bye-bye. And Kudus, thank you for your time, huh? And this has been wonderful.
Thank you very much. And that's been a wonderful journey for me as well. And hopefully we get more time with more people to continue to have these conversations.
Oh, definitely. You know, it's like what you did in Lagos, you know, bringing, you know, people, all the voices together from different places. Have a lovely day. I don't know. It's still early for you. It's nice.
No, it's too early.